For this Tuesday, June 9th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. A final farewell for George Floyd. The death of an African-American man, which has sparked change here in this country and worldwide. In fact, the D.C. City Council today passing a sweeping slate of measures to reform police conduct in this city. It comes as communities around the country are looking for reforms within law enforcement agencies. The Washington Post has put together a minute-by-minute account as the demonstrators gathered, explaining exactly what happened last Monday at Lafayette Park next to the White House. We'll have highlights and talk to one of the reporters who worked on that project. Meanwhile, the head of infectious diseases at NIH, Dr. Anthony Fauci, saying COVID-19 turned out to be, in his words, his worst nightmare. In an interview, he pointed out that in just 4 months, it has devastated the world. The global death toll has surpassed 408,000, with more than 7.1 million confirmed cases. The story shaping Washington today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin in Houston. His death, the video which showed a Minneapolis police officer on his neck as he tried to breathe for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. His plea, "I can't breathe," it sparked a movement. Today, friends and family had a chance to say a final farewell to George Floyd. We carried the funeral service live here on C-SPAN Radio with tributes, song, and prayers. The service for George Floyd, including those who eulogized the 46-year-old African-American man, Reverend Al Sharpton.
All over the world, I've seen grandchildren of slave masters tearing down slave master statue over in England and put it in the river. I'll pour out my spirit among all flesh. I've seen whites walking past curfews saying no Black Lives Matter, no justice, no peace. I'll pour out my spirit among all flesh. You have now lived to where you've sown wickedness, and now you have to reap the wrath of those that don't want to be wicked no more. That a man sows, that shall he also reap. So we come because God, in his own way, he always, one of the ministers said it right, God always uses unlikely people to do his will. If George Floyd had been an Ivy League school graduate and one of these ones with a long title, we would have been accused of reacting to his prominence. If he'd been a multimillionaire, they would have said that we were reacting to his wealth. If he had been a famous athlete, as he was on the trajectory to be, we would have said we were reacting to his fame. But God took an ordinary brother from the third wall, from the housing projects, that nobody thought much about but those that knew him and loved him. He took the rejected stone, the stone that the builder rejected. They rejected him for jobs. They rejected him for positions. They rejected him to play certain teams. God took the rejected stone and made him the cornerstone of a movement that's going to change the whole wide world. I'm glad he wasn't one of these polished bourgeois brothers, because we'd have still thought we was of no value. But George was just George. And now you have to understand, if you father any one of us, it's a value to all of us.
From earlier today in Houston, Reverend Al Sharpton. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden traveled to Houston yesterday. He personally met with the Floyd family, and today, in a video tribute, he offered these words.
To George's children and grandchild, I know you miss your dad and your granddad. Little Gianna, As I said to you when I saw you yesterday, you're so brave. Daddy's looking down. He's so proud of you. I know you missed that bear hug that only he could give. The pure joy riding on his shoulders so you could touch the sky. The countless hours he spent playing any game you wanted because your smile, your laugh, your love is the only thing that mattered at the moment. I know you have a lot of questions, honey. No child should have to ask questions that too many black children have had to ask for generations. Why? Why is daddy gone? And looking through your eyes, we should also be asking ourselves why the answer is so often too cruel and painful. Why in this nation do too many black Americans wake up knowing that they could lose their life in the course of just living their life? Why does justice not roll like a river or righteousness like a mighty stream? Why? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we can't turn away. We must not turn away. We cannot leave this moment thinking we can once again turn away from racism that stings at our very soul, from systemic abuse that still plagues American life. As Thurgood Marshall once implored, quote, America must descend from indifference. It must descend from fear, the hatred, and the mistrust. We must descend because America can do better, because America has no choice but to do better. I grew up with Catholic social doctrine, which taught me that faith without works is dead, and you'll know us by what we do. Ladies and gentlemen, you've got to deal with the denial of the promise of this nation to so many people for so long. It's about who we are, what we believe, and maybe most importantly, who we want to be, to ensure that all men and women are not only created equal, but are treated equally. We can heal this nation's wounds and remember its pain, not callous the heart and forget.
That from former Vice President Joe Biden. George Floyd's funeral has been posted on our website. You can check it out at cspan.org. After today's public service, there was a private burial at Houston Memorial Gardens. As he was dying, he cried out for his mother. George Floyd's final resting place is next to his mother's gravesite. The service and tribute earlier today in Houston for George Floyd. Also today, here in Washington, President Trump's tweet about a 75-year-old Buffalo protester getting pushback from Republican senators. The president floating that an elderly man pushed to the ground by police in Buffalo, New York during a protest over the police killing of George Floyd could be, in his words, a setup and an Antifa provocateur. The tweet sparking immediate backlash from Republican senators, including this from GOP leader Mitch McConnell.
Yeah.
If you're talking about police reform here, this morning the president was tweeting about this Buffalo protester. We saw him on video, pushed over by police. He was bleeding. The president said that he could be an Antifa provocateur. He said that he fell harder than he pushed, and he questioned if he was set up. Is that appropriate?
Well, as I said, what we've been talking about here in the Senate Republican Conference is what we think is the appropriate response to the events of the last few weeks. And under the leadership and guidance of Senator Tim Scott, at some point in the near future, we'll have recommendations to be made.
What about the president's tweet, though? Was that appropriate, sir?
As I said, we are discussing in the Senate Republican Conference what response we think is appropriate to the events of the last 2 weeks. And once Senator Scott and his team decide what to recommend, we'll let you know.
Leader McConnell, do you have any thoughts about what should be done? Does anything, any police practices at the moment trouble you that you want to see fixed?
I told you how we're approaching this. I can tell you again if you'd like.
That's okay.
Okay.
Leader McConnell, on the great outdoors.
Yeah.
Can you talk about your record on civil rights and why you think it's important for the Republican Party to have a response to what's going on in the country right now?
Well, absolutely. I think it's important to have a response. And, you know, none of us have had the experience of being an African American in this country and dealing with this discrimination, which persists here some 50 years after the 1964 Civil Rights Bill and the 1965 Civil Rights Bill. And we're still wrestling with America's original sin. We try to get better, but every now and then it's perfectly clear we're a long way from the finish line. And I think the best way for the Senate Republicans to go forward on this is to listen to one of our own who's had these experiences. He's had them since he's been in the United States Senate. And with his guidance and leadership, we're going to come together with a proposal that we think makes the most sense for the federal government in the wake of what we've seen and experienced over the last couple of weeks.
Congressional reporters trying to get answers to the president's tweet from the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell. Here is the tweet that came out earlier today from the president at Real Donald Trump. Buffalo protester shoved by police could be an Antifa provocateur. 75-year-old Martin Gugino was pushed away after appearing to scan police communications in order to black out the equipment. His source, One America News. I watched. He fell harder than he was pushed. Was aiming scanner. Could be a setup. Well, the number two Senate Republican John Thune said, quote, "It is a serious accusation which should only be made with facts and evidence. I haven't seen any yet." When asked whether he thought that the president should stop making the accusation, Senator Thune said, quote, "Well, I think that's a given." And then these brief comments by Utah Senator Mitt Romney.
Yeah, I saw the tweet. It was a shocking thing to say, and I won't dignify it with any further comment.
That from Republican Senator Mitt Romney. Two Buffalo police officers, by the way, were charged with assault after that video went viral of them shoving the elderly person after he approached them during that protest. He staggered and fell backward, hitting his head on the concrete, laying motionless as the blood pooled on the sidewalk. The officers walked away. He remains in critical condition tonight in a Buffalo, New York hospital. The officers have pled not guilty. And this from an angry Governor Andrew Cuomo in response to the president's tweet.
President Trump did a tweet today that surprises me, even after all the tweets he has done. You read his tweets, you get to a point where you say, well, nothing could surprise me. I've seen it all. And then you get surprised again. You get shocked again. You get disgusted again. President of the United States, supposed to be a responsible position and a responsible person. He tweeted today that the protester in Buffalo who was hurt by the Buffalo police was on a video that went viral. Mr. Gugino, 75-year-old gentleman who was out protesting and is knocked to the ground by police. He's in the hospital in Buffalo. He was in intensive care. He's no longer in intensive care, but he's still hospitalized. I spoke to him the day he was brought into the hospital. The president tweets that this man may have been a member of Antifa and that he fell harder than he was pushed. Could be a setup. It's all made up. It's all fabricated. There's no fact to any of it. He accuses this man of being associated with Antifa. No proof whatsoever. No fact. Just an assertion. He fell harder than he was pushed. In the video, you see him pushed. And you see a 75-year-old man fall backwards and hit his head on the pavement. What does that even mean? Fell harder than he was pushed. What do you think it was? It was staged? You think the blood coming out of his head was staged? Is that what you're saying? You saw his head hit the pavement. You see blood on the pavement. Maybe he fell harder than he was pushed. How reckless, how irresponsible, how mean, how crude. I mean, if there was ever a reprehensible, dumb comment, and from the President of the United States, at this moment of anguish and anger, what does he do? Pours gasoline on the fire.
That from Governor Andrew Cuomo. This headline from the Buffalo News is Governor Cuomo goes off on the Trump tweet about that injured Buffalo protester, quoting the governor saying, show some decency. Well, as you heard earlier from the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, he announced today that he is tapping Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, who is the Senate's only African-American Republican, to put together a police reform package, a legislation that the Senate would act on. The GOP leader saying that his party needs to respond to civil unrest that has swept the country since the death of George Floyd. At a Capitol Hill news conference, this reaction from Democratic leader Chuck Schumer.
Senator McConnell said that Republicans will be working on their own police reform bill led by Senator Tim Scott. Is that something that the caucus is prepared to support?
Well, we don't know what it is yet. I'd make two points. One, this bill has been carefully thought out, and there are so many different areas of abuse. We need this whole bill put on the floor and debated, the whole Justice in Policing Act. To do one piece would do be a dereliction of our duty. And second, I am really worried. Remember when there was a lot of gun violence and McConnell said, oh, our caucus is going to discuss it, we're going to deal with it, et cetera, and then they never did. I'm worried the same thing would happen here.
This idea of defund the police, should members of Congress, it's being used by some on the right to reject police reform outright. Should members of Congress stop using it altogether and others in the progressive
movement? Well, let me just say this. I agree with Senator Sanders and some of my other colleagues who said, of course, every city needs a police department. But there must be full equality under the law, and we're clearly not there. So my top priority is going to be to focus on getting this bill done, the whole bill, to deal with accountability, to deal with transparency, to deal with police practices. It does things like ban police violence, like chokeholds. It creates a registry, as Maisie mentioned. It holds the police officers who have had a series of charges against them and things filed against them accountable. And the Justice in Policing Act also uses the power of the federal funding to incentivize police departments across the country to implement these desperately needed standards. That's my focus.
Maisie, by the way, is Senator Maisie Hirono of Hawaii, in those comments earlier today from Democratic leader in the U.S. Senate, Chuck Schumer. Meanwhile, in the House, 22 Republican members of the House Armed Services Committee are calling on the president not to reduce the number of U.S. troops in Germany. In a letter sent earlier today, the committee's ranking member, Congressman Mac Thornberry of Texas, joining 21 other committee Republicans, saying they are, quote, very concerned about reports that the president has approved withdrawing about 9,500 troops from Germany, as well as placing a cap on the number of U.S. troops there. Right now, there are an estimated 35,000 American troops in Germany, which, of course, is the headquarters for the U.S. European and African Command. Now to Campaign 2020 and comments made earlier today by Fox News Sunday anchor Chris Wallace. This is what he said on ABC's The View.
Trump is positioning himself as a law and order president, but these movements that we are seeing in the streets are protesting law enforcement as we know it. He's also reigniting the fight now over taking a knee in silent protest during the national anthem. Is this, in your view, the right tone for the president to be taking in this moment?
Well, I'm not going to talk about it in terms of right or wrong. I mean, you know, the president has his base and he has his beliefs and he's entitled to them. Let me talk about it in terms of politics. And I would say that the last week was a very bad week for the president in terms of politics, in terms of his potential reelection prospects. I mean, when you're getting called out by the Episcopal Bishop of Washington and the Archbishop of the Catholic Church of Washington, when you're getting called out, excuse me, by everybody from Jim Mattis to former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mike Mullen, and even your own current Secretary of Defense, Mike Esper, breaks with you, that's not a good week. He had some good news on the economy, but clearly, and you see there's a new poll in the Washington Post today that indicates by an almost 2-to-1 margin, people don't think the president has handled the last week properly, and his approval ratings and his standing in the polls has dropped. So, you know, you can argue as to whether he's right or wrong, but in politically, I think it's been a bad week.
Chris Wallace is the host of Fox News Sunday. His comments earlier today on ABC's The View. And joining us on the phone is Anita Kumar. She covers the White House and politics for Politico. What is the state of the Trump reelection campaign this evening?
Well, it's not what they wanted it to be, I guess, over at the campaign. You know, the last few months we've had to deal with, and they've had to deal with, the pandemic, the economy, now the protests. And what they're finding with their polling internally and public polling is that the president is down nationally, which is not maybe so surprising. But what has been worrying them is that he's really down in these key battleground states, so places like Ohio and Iowa. And he's even fallen in traditionally Republican states like Arizona and Georgia. And so there are some people that are worried for him, and there are people in the campaign trying to figure out what to do. The president himself, I've heard, has blamed the man at the top, which is Brad Parscale, his campaign manager. You kind of always look at the person who's in charge, and that's what the president's doing, saying, you know, what can we do about this?
And as you look at the polling, most recently that CNN poll that put the president's approval rating at about 38%, that is on par with Jimmy Carter in 1980, George H.W. Bush in 1992. They both lost.
Right. I mean, you know, the president has been sort of interesting to watch for 3.5 years, or really 3 years. His standing really didn't change. It was kind of in the 40s, and it hasn't really budged no matter what's happened, whatever crisis is out there. But what we're finding in the last few months is we're finally here in the general election. You know, this is the time that the campaign really wanted to talk about the strong economy. Remember, 3 or 4 months ago, that was what he was going to campaign on, this really booming economy. And then one thing has happened after another. Now, you could argue some of it is his own failing, right? He didn't respond the way he should have, people argue, about the coronavirus. But what he's found is that, which has been one thing after another, and they're afraid that he's lost ground. We're 5 months out, and they don't know if he can make it out.
And so that gets us to your piece at Politico.com. The headline, "The President Gets the 2016 Band Back Together as He Tumbles in the Polls." Is he looking at making some personnel changes in the campaign?
Yes, he's already brought back two people in the last couple days, two senior aides that he had in his headquarters last time, Boris Epstein and Jason Miller. But he's also looking, and this to me is the most important part, he's looking at bringing back two leaders he had in two pivotal states, Florida and Pennsylvania. In Florida, he's looking at bringing back Susie Wiles, who is a longtime Florida operator in Republican circles, who was fired actually last year because she had a dispute with the governor, who's a close friend of the president's. And David Urban, who is a former senior advisor in Pennsylvania and is credited with helping the president win Pennsylvania in 2016. And remember how big of a deal that was, that President Trump won Pennsylvania. A Republican hadn't won in quite some time, so that was a big get for him. He's looking at those two states and wondering how they can get that back. And he's looking to both of them to bring them on board, or at least have them unofficially come and have more prominent roles.
We talked to your colleague Mark Caputo, who covers Florida politics for Politico, and he said basically whoever wins Florida will win the general election this year.
That's right. When you talk to Republicans, they really say for a Republican president or Republican presidential candidate, the math doesn't add up unless they win Florida and all those electoral votes. So they're very much looking at that. This is a hugely important state to President Trump. I'm not even sure there's a more important state for so many reasons. Remember, he has property there. He now calls Florida home. His official residence is Mar-a-Lago. It's a large, diverse state. He's very close to the governor, Ron DeSantis, both senators there. And, you know, he feels like it's a place that he should win. He narrowly won it last time, and it's something that he's really concentrating on. But the last couple of days, I've really been talking to a lot of people, Republicans on the ground there, and they're very worried. They still think that the president has an edge there, but they're worried because they think that Republicans haven't kept up the grassroots efforts in the last 3 years. So when 2016 happened, the election was done, that they didn't stay on the ground and really rally the troops and get them going for 2020. And they're really worried that, you know, you dormant for a few years and then you come back and then try to do this all at once. It just doesn't work. And so they're really wanting to get someone in there in these last 5 months to get everything organized.
The story posted at Politico.com. Anita Kumar here in Washington. Thank you for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
It was more than 50 years ago, another moment of racial unrest and urban riots in this country, and these words from Dr. Martin Luther King.
Our dreams will sometime be shattered, and our ethereal hopes blasted.
On our podcast, The Weekly, a conversation with Camille Bousset. She is a Brookings Senior Fellow with an expertise in racial and economic inequality and some of the lessons from MLK.
Dr. King was an incredible unifier, and I think one of the things that has really been true, was really true during the Civil Rights Movement, when Dr. King was alive and certainly even after, was that we had true leadership around civil rights and human rights.
More on this moment in our country's history and the path forward for state and local leaders. Our topic on The Weekly. The podcast is available on the web at cspan.org/podcast. And after you listen, be sure to rate and review us. We look forward to hearing your comments. You're listening to Washington Today here on C-SPAN Radio. Here are some of your headlines. The Senate confirming General Charles Brown Jr. is the next chief of staff for the Air Force, setting the stage for the veteran fighter pilot to become the first African-American service chief in U.S. military history. And the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the president last week was on the brink of firing Defense Secretary Mark Esper in the dispute over the use of federal troops for protests. The full story at WSJ.com. In Georgia, the Secretary of State, as well as that state's House Speaker, calling for investigations into voting delays in Atlanta and across the state on this primary day. The announcement of the investigations come after a rocky start for voters, primarily in Atlanta, despite spending more than $100 million in new voting machines. In multiple sites in Fulton County, voting machines were down. Some sites were waiting for technical support. Others had difficulty logging into the machines, and the lines were very long. The executive director of the new Georgia Project said today's voting was, quote, a hot, flaming mess. Today's development will likely further spark the mail-in ballot debate. Here in Washington, on the Senate floor, Republican Chuck Grassley of Iowa talked about what's working in his state.
The House of Representatives has passed a bill that's kind of a like one-size-fits-all for elections, that everything ought to be run out of Washington, D.C., contrary to what we've done in this country for 240 years, where we've had 50 states running the elections. So I want to refer to what happens in the state of Iowa. Last week, Iowans voted in record numbers in our June primary. In most elections, about 40% of Iowans choose to vote by absentee ballot. This year, in our primary, and understandably because of the pandemic, the vast majority cast their votes by absentee ballot. A state decision, a personal decision, not something dictated by Washington. Now, as I've already referred to, there are those here in Washington, D.C., in the Congress, and maybe outside of the Congress, saying that unless the federal government mandates states adopt a whole new centralized, non-optional vote by mail system before November, Americans will not be able to vote from home. Iowa's successful primary election shows that the absentee ballot system, already in place in our state, in most states, run by Iowa County auditors, is up to the task. We've proved that. Every Iowan who wants to vote absentee in November can do so. And those who want to vote in person can also do so safely.
That's from the senior Republican from Iowa, Chuck Grassley, and Reid Epstein of the New York Times writing the following, quote, eight states and Washington, D.C. holding primary elections today, and the drama is less about which presidential candidate Democrats support and more about how voters and election officials adopt to voting by mail. The contests in Indiana, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island, they were postponed from dates in April and May, giving voters time to request and return those absentee ballots. In Iowa, Montana, New Mexico, South Dakota, and here in Washington, D.C., they have largely transitioned from traditional primaries to ones conducted by mail. Together, writes Reid Epstein, it is a potential warm-up for the November general election, when voting by mail could be paramount because of coronavirus. At WashingtonPost.com, this headline, the crackdown before Trump's photo op, how law enforcement cleared protesters outside the White House. A team of reporters putting together a timeline showing what smartphone video and other records indicated about the clearing of those protesters outside the White House. And we'll talk to one of those reporters who worked on the project. But first, here's a portion. It runs 12 minutes. We pick it up as law enforcement begin the use of force as a way to disperse the crowd.
Members of the Bureau of Prison Special Operations Response Team, identified by their patches, are soon seen arriving at the barricades. The unit is trained to put down riots and resolves hostage situations in federal prisons. They are rarely deployed in public. They are among several groups armed with pepperball guns and canister launchers. The canister launcher seen here can fire a projectile that breaks on impact, expelling irritant powder. If fired directly at a person, the canister can cause serious injury or even death. The pepperball gun seen here fires small balls of a chemical irritant derived from hot peppers. A metal canister is seen here on the vest of law enforcement. The orange markings on the canister match those of tear-inducing chemical grenades. At 6:32, officers receive the orders to push back the largest group of protesters, the group on H Street. They advance on the crowd. The protesters retreat. The police line stops next to St. John's Church. A park police sergeant, identified by his white helmet, warns a protester.
Now!
You better back up!
I need
you down!
You're
cool!
I'm going down!
You are
the threat!
You are the threat!
At 6:35 on H Street, park police officers rush again toward the protesters. Other officers quickly follow. A chemical grenade is rolled. It is unclear by whom. A large explosion is heard. CNN cameras filming the scene from above show the crowd turning and running. A park police officer strikes an Australian cameraman with a shield and grabs his camera. Another officer is seen swinging a baton at reporters' back as she and the cameraman flee. Park police push a group of protesters west on H Street. A protester films pepper balls fired toward the crowd. They can be heard striking the ground.
Keep moving. They got pepper balls. Keep moving.
A member of the park police SWAT team throws a sting ball grenade into the crowd. The devices are designed to explode, firing rubber balls in a radius of up to 50 feet. Several Park Police SWAT team members and a member of the Bureau of Prisons tactical team are seen firing pepper balls into the fleeing crowd.
Stop shooting them! Why are you shooting us?
In a matter of minutes, the skirmish line surges past St. John's Church. Police pause a few feet beyond the intersection. On camera, a park police officer wearing a yellow helmet is seen gesturing at officers to hold the line at 16th and H Street Northwest. A minute later, on 16th Street, a park police SWAT team officer crouches down to roll a chemical grenade toward the protesters.
Another tear gas bomb right at our feet. We're going to move back from this right now.
Arlington units, we are going all the way to I Street. Copy, I Street.
A line of at least 12 mounted park police officers are deployed to disperse the crowd. At 6:44, the president begins to speak in the Rose Garden. He's minutes away from leaving the White House to go to the church.
My fellow Americans, my first and highest duty as president is to defend our great country and the American people.
Outside, officers detain protesters.
That is just a portion of what happened a week ago Monday. The full 12-minute video is available on the Washington Post website. And joining us on the phone is investigative reporter Dalton Bennett. How did this all come about?
Well, really the idea was, how could we better understand what took place in front of the White House on June 1st? And, you know, at the time we were getting a particular message from the White House, we saw videos that were being uploaded on social media. And, you know, as a paper, we just wanted to go out there and try to figure out the best way to reconstruct the events that took place on June 1st. So what we did is, myself and several of my colleagues, we began collecting and reaching out to anybody that had made posts online, people that happened to be there outside of the White House when it was cleared by law enforcement that included the United States Park Police, Secret Service, and in some cases, the Bureau of Prisons. And what we decided to do was, we gathered this footage and audio of police transmissions, and we wanted to put together a very succinct and comprehensive timeline to understand how the protests unfolded, what the actions were of the protests, and most importantly, what actions the law enforcement that was there, what actions they took in order to clear the protests. Now, in doing that, it was a fairly complicated process that required a huge amount of resources and effort, but we were able to geolocate the exact locations of every video that we're able to track down. So we were able to tell the exact time and place in which it was filmed. That provided a really rounded understanding of what was happening minute by minute over this course of an entire hour that led to the clearing of this area of protesters.
And with that video, the audio, and the graphics, you really do tell the story of what happened in the early evening hours. As you put this together, what surprised you the most?
Well, I think the most surprising thing for me was to see, and also my colleagues that I work with, was just to see the level and the intensity of the response by law enforcement. I've worked overseas in countries including Russia, Greece, the UK, places that have a lot of experience with crowd control. And for me to see the type of force in some cases that was used was certainly surprising. We were able to identify pepper ball guns that were used by law enforcement personnel that were in the area that were fired at protesters that were largely peaceful. We were able to identify canisters that were on law enforcement personnel that are OC canisters, or the markings match those of OC canisters, which is a tear-inducing chemical grenade. And for me, that was one of the big takeaways. I was very surprised by also the size and the proportion of the response. There were an overwhelming show of force. Now, in the process of reporting this out, we also learned more just about tactics that had been adopted by police departments and also by law enforcement personnel. Also learned about the challenges that, you know, law enforcement faced by trying to organize this entire operation. It seems that, you know, communication was definitely a challenge on the ground, and watching the videos that we were able to track down, you could see at times, certain agencies are having problems communicating to one another or struggling to communicate with one another. But overwhelmingly, I would say the most surprising thing from this entire body of reporting that we've been focusing on, and was a team of us that worked on this project, would just be the type of force that was used and how quickly they were able to ultimately disperse dozens of largely peaceful protesters.
Again, the full video is available at WashingtonPost.com, a minute-by-minute account of the scene outside the White House at Lafayette Park. And Dalton Bennett, you said it was a labor-intensive project. How many resources and how much video did you have to go through?
So for this process itself, it was a huge team effort. I mean, we were going through hours and hours of footage, of social media posts, of reviewing police audio transmissions. I mean, the amount of effort that went into this, I would say, would have to be one of the biggest projects that we've undertaken in such a tight time frame. We were able to put out this reconstruction within a week of it actually happening. And ultimately, you know, all those sleepless nights, the amount of time and effort that went into this, it was for one purpose. And that purpose was to have a better understanding and clarity around this really important event that, and from a very basic and essential perspective, that's exactly what journalism is about.
At WashingtonPost.com, investigative reporter Dalton Bennett, we thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
On Wall Street, the Dow snapping a six-day winning streak at the closing bell, the big board losing 300 points. The S&P was down 25, but the NASDAQ gained 29 points. And Bloomberg News reporting on the economy, as many as 25,000 U.S. stores may close this year, largely as a result of the pandemic, most of those stores affecting shopping malls across the country. For those of you listening on C-SPAN Radio, Washington Today is also available as a podcast. You can find it on the web at cspan.org/podcasts. Thanks for joining us for this Tuesday edition. I hope you enjoyed the rest of your evening.